Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. In this week's show, we'll be talking about music and protest, the history of working men and women expressing their grievances in song. In particular, we'll be talking about strike songs of the Great Depression. And after that, Benjamin Filene will pay tribute to one of America's great musicologists and collectors of folk music and folklore, Alan Lomax, who died this year at the age of 87. But before we get to those subjects, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on December 18, 1865, the people of the United States ratified the 13th Amendment, and so the ethos that neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction became a part of the U.S. Constitution. Prior to the Civil War, only the abolitionists who sought to completely eradicate slavery would have endorsed the 13th Amendment. Others, even the anti-slavery Republican Party, were more restrained, seeking only to prevent the spread of slavery into the new territories of the West. Abraham Lincoln's election of the presidency in 1860 prompted Southern secession, which led to civil war. And as the war dragged on, many in the North, including Lincoln, decided it was time to destroy the South's peculiar institution. On September 22, 1862, Lincoln issued a proclamation declaring that as of January 1, 1863, all persons held as slaves in territories then in rebellion against the United States would be free, and what began as a war to save the Union became a war to end slavery, a goal fully realized with the passage of the 13th Amendment this week in history.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, we have an update on the Vinland map story. You may recall that this past Columbus Day, we reported that controversy continues to surround the authenticity of the map, discovered in 1957, that purports to be a medieval artifact verifying the Norse voyages to America 5 centuries before Columbus. While yet another scholar has weighed in on the side of those who believe it is a forgery. Kirsten Seaver, an authority on the Norse voyages in the North Atlantic, has concluded that the Vinland map was the work of a German Jesuit named Joseph Fischer in the 1930s. Fischer, she believes, made the map not only to promote the Norse voyages to North America, but also to protest the Nazi regime. Fischer, Seaver argues, was outraged by the Nazi persecution of Jesuits, so while promoting the Norse claim, Fischer frequented the map with Catholic imagery, in one instance including a legend which read that Eric the Red traveled to Vinland as a legate of the Apostolic See and the Bishop of Greenland. It was all a ruse, Seaver concludes, attempting to establish the Norse discovery of America while making clear it was Catholic as well. This is Talking History. Histories of American labor abound. So too do studies of American music. Far fewer are the books that seek to link the two, that investigate the connections between music and popular movements. Talking History's Fred Nielsen, professor of history at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, explores one such link between music and the strikers of the Great Depression with his guest, Timothy Lynch.
Music and protest have long gone together in America. Working men and women have expressed their grievances, stirred themselves to action, and found solidarity in the communal experience of singing. According to my guest, Timothy Lynch, the late 1920s and 1930s were among the richest periods for such musical protest. He is a professor of history at the College of Mount St. Joseph in Cincinnati and the author of Strike Songs of the Depression. Professor Lynch, welcome.
Thank you.
You quote one observer in 1929 as saying that songs were better than 100 speeches. Why was that? What makes them so effective?
Well, I think part of it, a good part of it, is that songs tend to pique someone's emotions. They hit them in their heart as well as their head. Songs can also be a collective experience where speakers is much more of a solitary activity, albeit being listened to by an audience, but singing can involve an entire group. It can also provide what I'll call the psychological space that, in the case of my book, that workers it could enjoy even when they had so few other tools at their disposal. One author has referred to it as song singing and songwriting as a weapon of the weak. So it becomes one form, one manner in which workers can express their, what I'll call their claim to justice, in simple, concise, and emotional fashion.
Where do strike songs, labor songs, the words and music typically come from?
The ones that I discuss in my book, the ones from Gastonia, North Carolina, and from Harlan County, Kentucky, those songs, most often the models for the songs that the striking workers wrote and sang, came from a rich stock of mountain ballads, folk songs, hymns. And because of that, the idiom of the folk song, of the mountain ballad, gave a kind of legitimacy to the claims that the workers were making. So by redressing the song, by grafting lyrics that address their concerns as workers, and grafting that to familiar songs of the people themselves, of their culture, it gave them, I think, a particular power. Now, in Flint, the culture is much more heterogeneous. The area was much more touched by what I'll call commercial music, what might be referred to as Tin Pan Alley. And in that area, it was the song, the models for the strike songs were from commercial, from radio, from commercial recordings. So the sources of the songs are varied, but I think there's, in among the strikes that I deal with, the Gastonia and Harlan, much more from a stock of folk music, mountain ballads, and hymns, where Flint is much more from the commercial Tin Pan Alley stock of songs.
Well, particularly in the first two strikes that you mentioned, in North Carolina and Kentucky, southern sites, there's an interesting amalgamation. The ideas expressed in the words are often radical ideas, and yet they've been grafted onto very very traditional songs. My Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean, Hot Time in the Old Town Tonight, On Top of Old Smoky, and so on.
Yes, and I think what that suggests is, even though in both of those instances, in Gastonia and in Harlan, the strikes ultimately would fail. It would be later in the 1930s that the United Mine Workers, for example, would effectively unionize the coal mines in Kentucky and Tennessee, West Virginia. What often has been interpreted as the failure of workers to unionize earlier, and there's a number of reasons, but among those reasons was that the workers never had a sense of themselves as a social class, as an economic class, that they had never come to understand the importance of collective action in an effort to win higher wages, better working conditions, etc. I think what the song lyrics that they wrote and sang suggest is that even if in a somewhat imperfect way, even if in somewhat guarded way, they were beginning to recognize that they had to use the words of Ella Mae Wiggins, stand together to have a union here. And sometimes that aspect of those strikes is lost. It's simply their efforts towards collective action is simply discounted.
You just mentioned Ella Mae Wiggins. She was the most important songwriter during the 1929 Gastonia textile workers' strike. Tell us a little bit about her, if you would.
She's an interesting woman. She was born in Sevierville, Tennessee in 1900. Her family moved to Andrews, North Carolina, which was a logging camp, when she was very young. She married at 16. Her husband, shortly after they were married, had his leg crushed in a logging accident. In an effort to provide for the family, they moved to Gastonia. The family was induced to move by company representatives, agents that came into the area trying to get people to move to Gastonia and other mill towns to work in the mills. her husband did some odd jobs around the mill, but became despondent, turned to drink, and ultimately left her. By that time, she had had 8 children. 4 of them had died of the whooping cough, which she calls it. She does have a 9th child later on, but she very much typifies what many, many families went through in the 1920s and 30s as they moved out of their homes in the hills and moved to the Piedmont area to work in the textile mills.
Probably one of her most important songs was a mill mother's lament. We don't have a recording by her. I don't believe she was ever actually recorded. The recording we're going to hear is by Pete Seeger. Is there anything you'd like to say about the song before we hear it?
I think it's a wonderfully powerful song about what so many women experienced, and I think the reason it was the favorite of so many of the strikers in Gastonia was because it spoke to them. It wasn't just Ella May's experience, it was their experience.
Well, let's hear A Mill Mother's Lament.
We leave our homes in the morning, we kiss our children goodbye. While we slave for the bosses, our children scream and cry. And when we draw our money, our grocery bills to pay, not a cent to spend for clothing, not a cent to lay away. And on that very evening, our little son will say, I need some shoes, mother, and so does Sister May. How it grieves the heart of a mother, you everyone must know. But we can't buy for our children, our wages are too low. It is for our little children that seem to us so dear. But for us nor them, dear workers, the bosses do not care. But understand, all workers, our union they do fear. Let's stand together, workers, and have a union here.
We should perhaps add that Ella May was murdered late in the strike, and some thought it was because of the songs she had written.
Yes, while that's never been proved, her fellow workers felt that she had been marked by the bosses and their hired hands, their hired guns. In fact, there had been an earlier attempt to poison her well. So that suggests, I think, a couple of things. First of all, there may be a great deal of truth in the claim made by her fellow workers that she was being singled out by the bosses because of her songwriting. But I think it also suggests implicitly the power that her songs had to state the claim to justice that is part of that song, or that is the message of that song.
Both at Gastonia and the Harlan coal miner strike later in Kentucky in 1931 and 32, you point out that women were among the most important writers of strike songs. I wonder, were the songs that women sang and wrote different from the songs that men sang and wrote?
Very much so. The songs that women wrote and sang, both as strikers in Gastonia and as allies to strikers in Harlan and in Flint, those songs speak about the struggle for a union in terms that would benefit the family. So a family wage, better security for their children, a chance for education for their children, food on the table, et cetera. The songs that men wrote often put the accent on brotherhood of workers, male solidarity and camaraderie, the struggle of the men together in fighting against the bosses. So they were, excuse the play on words, strikingly different in terms of what the strike and what victory in the strike could mean for them.
One example of that comes from the Harlan strike of the early 30s in Kentucky. The most important balladeer of that strike, you suggest, was Aunt Molly Jackson, an interesting combination of Baptist faith and left-wing politics. We're going to hear her singing Ragged Hungry Blues, a song of her own. Is there anything we should know about that?
Well, this is one of the few songs that we have from this period that was recorded while a strike was going on. She traveled in December of 31 to New York City to help raise strike funds. And when she was there, she recorded Ragged Hungry Blues. And so it's unique in that regard. It is actually from the period when the strike was going on.
Well, let's hear Ragged Hungry Blues, Aunt Molly Jackson.
Friends and comrades, I've had some very interesting letters from Kentucky this morning, and I have so much on my mind I hardly know how to address you. And I will endeavor to sing to you my hungry, wearied blues that I composed when I was down there suffering with those people, and now wait until I can strike a note of call. I'm sad and weary. I've got the hungry, ragged blues. I'm sad and weary. I've got the hungry, ragged blues. Not a penny in the pocket to buy one thing I need. I woke up this morning with the worst blues I ever had in my life. I woke up this morning with the worst blues I ever had in my life. Not a bite to cook for breakfast, a poor coal miner's wife. When my husband works in the coal mine, he loads a car on every trip. When my husband works in the coal mine, he loads a car on every trip. Then he goes to the office that evening to get the night off. Just because it took all he made that day to pay his.
Most labor songs typically pit workers against employers, the good guys versus the bad guys. Yet the most famous song from the Harlan strike, Which Side Are You On, actually focused on the splits between the workers themselves.
Yes, Florence Reese, who was the wife of a labor organizer, a striker in Harlan, they came looking for Sam Reese, the gun thugs of the Harlan mines, and they came trying to run him out of town. And he was lying low, as Florence describes it. And Florence was so worked up by the experience of these men trying to hunt down her husband that she took, as she describes it, took the back of a calendar because she had no paper available and wrote down the lyrics to Which Side Are You On? And in that song, the chorus or the refrain of that song, when Florence asks, which side are you on, it's after having addressed the workers, saying, come all you poor workers, good news to you I'll tell, how the good old union has come in here to dwell. And then she asks them, which side are you on? And she goes on to say, we're starting our good battle, we know we're sure to win. Because we've got the gun thugs looking very thin. And again, she asked them, which side are you on? So in the midst of this battle, are you with us or are you against us? And it echoes a problem. That the union organizers had in Harlan, and that was the only coal miners that they could get to support the union tended to be the ones that were already blacklisted, already not working. It became very, very difficult to get workers who were in the mines to come out of the mines on strike. So she was really addressing them, suggested, putting it to them quite succinctly, you're either on the side of the union and a better wage, better working conditions, better future for our children, or you're on the side of the bosses. And in that sense, it's a unique song because it's asking the workers which side they're standing on.
The auto workers' sit-down strike in Flint, Michigan in 1936 has been described as the most significant American labor conflict in the 20th century. What role did songs play in that strike?
It's a very different strike from the other two in that, the strikers end up victorious. Sidney Fine, labor historian, has described it as the most significant American labor conflict in the 20th century, and I think that's well put. So first of all, they are victorious, but the tactic that they used, actually taking control of a key plant in the Flint, the GM Flint production line, made passing the time, fighting boredom, having something to do with all this time on their hands. They're in the plant for some 44 days. So one of the functions of music was simply a way of combating the boredom. Their allies, their wives, their other strikers who were not actually holding the plant would also use song and singing on the picket lines. So it served as a way of both boosting the morale of those on the lines and also those in the factories itself. And at one critical point late in the strike, music singing among those on the picket lines was actually done as something of a diversionary tactic to make the company police believe that they were making an assault on another plant, and indeed it was simply a diversionary tactic as they took control of a different part of the plant.
Well, Professor Lynch, thanks so much for visiting with us today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Timothy Lynch, the author of Strike Songs of the Depression. As we go out, why don't we listen to Sit Down, a song from the Flint Strike of 1936. What should we know about this song as we leave?
Well, it was written by Maurice Sugar, who was an attorney for the UAW. He had written some labor songs before the strike, but his role during the 36-37 Flint sit-down strike was as an attorney, providing legal counsel. But he knew from previous labor struggles that song has a particularly powerful role to play in boosting morale and having the strikers hold firm to their demands. And so it's interesting in that regard. It was actually crafted during the strike and by someone whose efforts on behalf of the UAW was not composing music, but providing legal counsel.
Welcome back. In our commentary of the week, we mark the passing of Alan Lomax, musicologist and collector of folk music and folklore, who died on July 19, 2002. He was 87 years old. Lomax worked tirelessly to preserve the creative output of hundreds of American folk singers, musicians, and storytellers. He recorded the songs of prisoners, gospel choirs, New Orleans jazz composers, cotton pickers, blues singers, Cajun fiddlers, Dust Bowl balladeers, and country music performers. Studs Terkel called Lomax a key figure in 20th century culture. Bob Dylan described him as a missionary. This week, Benjamin Filene offers a fresh perspective on Alan Lomax and his legacy.
The first and only time I talked to Alan Lomax, he wanted to hit me in the face. As a graduate student, I sent him an article I had written that analyzed his and his father's relationship with the singer Leadbelly, and I asked for an interview. An irate phone call followed. "I don't want to talk to you. I want to punch you in the nose." Since his death on July 19th, Alan Lomax has been lauded for preserving folk music voices that might otherwise have been lost to time. Indeed, Lomax was the first to understand fully that the recording machine could save nuggets of tradition from the flood of popular culture that threatened to wash them away, and the first with the savvy to use mass media to spread the word about the riches he had retrieved. He also was a tireless seeker of sounds, the first to thrust a microphone before Woody Guthrie, Muddy Waters, Leadbelly, and countless hundreds of other musicians in prisons, shacks, and shanties who became part of America's folk music fabric. Lomax was comfortable discussing and taking credit for his role in, quote, discovering musicians and preserving tradition. But, as my telephone encounter with him suggests, he didn't like to acknowledge his role as a creator of tradition. In truth, though, the cultural filtering that Lomax did in the course of a lifetime of listening, recording, and promoting is perhaps his most powerful legacy. He deserves recognition for establishing the notion that there is such a thing as an American folk music tradition and for delineating the contours of that tradition as we understand it today. Lomax was not a dispassionate documentarian. He was a canon builder, an advocate, and, not the least, a promoter of a vision of what American music is and isn't. Lomax and his father, John, made the decisive break with the notion that folk songs existed only in the distant past. Most collectors before them had scoured the Appalachians looking for vestiges of British ballads, particularly those codified in the late 19th century by Francis Child. The Lomaxes insisted that folk music was a living tradition and that America had its own vibrant strains. Allen, in particular, placed African-American music squarely at the center of the nation's musical heritage, a dramatic reordering of the canon that had incalculable influence. He saw folk music not as a dusty relic, but a coursing stream, one that could nourish a mainstream society sadly in need of vitality. Even so, Lomax was always ambivalent about some of the directions that stream threatened to drift. Not all cultural adaptations were equal in his book. On field recording expeditions, he guided musicians to repertoire that he saw as traditional, rejecting the pop hits they often offered him first. In his popular songbooks, he pieced together the best lyrics of songs from multiple versions, often copywriting the results. And in writings and interviews, he conjured up heartfelt but romanticized visions of the musicians he treasured, most baldly in the stereotype portrayals of Lead Belly he and his father hyped in the 1930s, but continuing through his National Book Award-winning account, Land Where the Blues Began, from 1993. Lomax saw traditional music as a rough-edged challenge to homogenizing mass culture, and he preferred the musicians themselves to have raw emotiveness as well. The result was an aesthetic of remarkable power, an emphasis on authenticity both in sound and personal demeanor. Lomax offered middle-class white audiences pathways into the foreign worlds of the folk and suggested what they should look for when they got there: unbridled passion, unselfconscious expression, the scent of violence. Today, this cult of authenticity penetrates not only folk revival circles, but musical scenes from alternative country to gangster rap. Everyone thirsts for the real thing. Alan Lomax certainly did not create the cult of authenticity single-handedly, but more than any other individual in the 20th century, he fanned the flames of dissatisfaction with mass-produced music and urged his followers to find a more pure way. He was a missionary more than a reporter.
You've been listening to Benjamin Filene, author of Romancing the Folk, Public Memory, and American Roots Music. Filene's commentary comes to us courtesy of the Talking History Project at the University of Albany, State University of New York, with special thanks to Project Director Gerald Zahavi. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History, and as always, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions, either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu, or to Talking History care of the Department of History, University of Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Information about the OAH and Talking History is available at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.